This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby. And what show do we imagine this might be?
I think this is number 154.
Wow. Okay. So here's show 154. I brought in one of my favorite quotes from Mark Rothko. It's the kind of thing that gets my juices flowing. And Alan is going to be the reader.
The progression of a painter's work as it travels in time from point to point will be toward clarity, toward the elimination of all obstacles between the painter and the idea, and the idea and the observer. To achieve this clarity is inevitably to be understood. The fact that people break down and cry when confronted with my pictures shows that I can communicate these basic human emotions. The people who weep before my pictures are having the same religious experience I had when painting them. And if you say you are moved only by their color relationships, then you miss the point. I'm not an abstractionist. I am not interested in the relationship of color or form or anything else. I'm interested only in expressing basic human emotions, tragedy, ecstasy, doom, and so on. It is a widely accepted notion among painters that it does not matter what one paints as long as it is well painted. This is the essence of academicism. There is no such thing as good painting about nothing. Well, I can get excited about too.
All right. Go ahead. What do you say about this?
Well, it's just the idea.
I mean, this is the essence of what I believe painting's all about. So let's hear you.
I love the notion that, I mean, I've always admired people with great rendering skills. It's just fantastic. My sister could sit down in the living room with her sketchbook and, you know, in 20 minutes she'd have a perspective drawing of the living room with everything in it. And it was like magic. And I would start to do them, and then I would quickly discover that I didn't like the process. I wasn't interested in reproducing the living room, although I would have loved to be able to just wave my hand around the way she seemed to be doing and recreate things that way. But it seemed to me there was something else involved. The act of drawing a picture with a pencil, even, you know, as a kid, was itself more important than the thing that I was drawing. And this notion that Rothko puts so emphatically, if I read it correctly, that just because you can do very highly representational work and do it with consummate skill and follow all of somebody's set of procedures for doing it the best way, it's the content that matters. And the content in a Rothko work doesn't come from any of those elements that you study in learning how to paint things. He wasn't painting things. He was using the act of painting to express something. And somehow that gets caught on the canvas. It's not that he looked at something and said, I'm going to figure out a way to make a representation of that on the canvas. So it's almost the extreme of the departure from classical painting, from illustration to something completely transcendental.
But it's also the extreme away from academic formalism.
Well, yeah, and explicitly,
he's really digging into those guys who believe that it's that composing forms without any representational reference is also purely academic if it doesn't convey deep human emotion.
And yet at the same time, his paintings, even the later ones, which are so delightfully indescribable, they still are juxtaposed fields with compositional elements in them. And if I may be so bold, it reminds me of what I've been discovering in my sound work, where I've been going for purely abstract, the most abstract possible kinds of sounds. But within them, there are things that you recognize or half recognize. And it's by placing a few opportunities for recognizing at planned distances from each other in the timing of the piece, that you use a little bit of formal musical composition in this domain of pure abstraction, and it lends it just a hint of structure and just a hint of that satisfaction that, oh, it's not completely abstract, I recognize something. But the something that you're recognizing is indescribable. And in a sense, you know, Rothko's often are a big section and a small section, and what they say to each other is completely indescribable, but the fact that it's not just one uniform canvas or one, at first glance, seemingly uniform canvas, he could have extended that deep, wild, amazing 15,000-hued blue right off the edges of the canvas, and that would have been very different. But you get to see it emerging from its environment, which is something else, and just the else-ness of it is enough to make it dramatic in its own right.
And when you see that room in the Tate Gallery where you're just surrounded by nothing but Rothkos, what's so remarkable about that room is that people sit, there are benches in there, and people sit on the benches and stop talking.
Yeah.
The paintings do something to them, and there are many young people you see in there who just have no idea what's happening to them from seeing these paintings, but exactly what Rothko wanted to have happen, where the viewer taps into the emotion that he felt when he's painting, does happen.
I mean, he's the best person to make this statement.
Yeah, absolutely.
He and his paintings go perfectly together, and that... Yeah. Injunction, the first paragraph of The Painter's Job I don't think anyone has achieved such success in that as he has.
Yeah.
And it's, you can't put your finger on how he does it either.
No.
Except for pure intention and lifelong devotion to his religion of doing this.
And if you look at his earlier work, there isn't a hint of that
either. That he took it past a certain point where he went into the pure idea and manifestation of the pure idea.
Well, and once you get, I mean, it can happen on an early stage too, because in teaching art classes, I noticed there are people who actually want to learn how to draw, you know, a flower or something like that that looks like a flower, or want to learn how to draw perspective. And so I've kind of given in and given some classes like that. The atmosphere in those classes is usually a little stiff. It's like the people are worried about, oh, I don't know, I didn't get this line right and all this stuff. And then, but if I have classes, like I had one the other day, which was about mixing sand with paint, it was a very popular class. Lots of people took it, and the whole feeling in the room, because they didn't expect, they were playing with materials and they didn't expect to do a fine rendering. They expected to just explore what would happen if you mixed sand into your paint. And the paintings are marvelous. They're full of energy. The whole atmosphere in the room was different from the other kind of classes. And these were people who had never done that before. They had never mixed sand with paint. They didn't have any idea what it was going to turn out like. Mm-hmm. And they just like rolled with it and turned out paintings that were loaded with emotion and beauty and energy.
So it brings up the whole issue of content, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That what are we delivering? And the idea that he talks about, we could name it many different things, but there's an essential experience inside that an artist has that he feels compelled to get across one way or another, and then the artist's task is figuring out a way to get that across. And we find that someone can have a lot of these students that come in, like you're describing, will have an experience around looking at a flower. Mm-hmm. And then they'll think that they can talk about that experience by copying the image of the flower. And yet the image of the flower doesn't contain that. It's usually a dead thing. Mm-hmm. So how do you go inside and capture that experience? And that's what artists do.
And it's interesting, you used the expression getting it across. And I think some artists are only trying to get it out. And other artists are trying to get it across. You know, some artists are thinking about the viewer and some aren't. And it leads to very different issues in creating the work. Because, I mean, I've been doing these lecture, projects for MUM and talking about sound and talking about music and hearing and so forth, and acoustics to a freshman is a whole different process. If I know I'm talking to a freshman, I'm not going to start with Vaisheshika. And I'm not going to start with acoustics. I'm going to start with a little bit about the physiology. And there's a whole bunch of points I'd like to make that I'm not going to be able to make for a while. And if I'm talking to, no offense to any freshmen who may be listening to this program, but there are some points that are going to take, 5 days to communicate over a period of time. And that those 5 days typically are going to be spread out over months. And there are other things you can get across in 10 minutes without boring people to death. And I'm going to be speaking at the music festival that MUM is doing at the Sondheim in the beginning of August. And it's a luncheon presentation. People are going to be sitting there eating for 20 minutes, and then I'm going to talk for 30 minutes. So I'm not going to be trying to get into terribly esoteric things. I've got to have my attention on getting my message across, not just getting it out. And that's one of the curious things about art, because some artists are, in a sense, in the garret. They don't think about the gallery. They don't want to know the gallery. They don't want to have a show. They don't want to meet the people who look at their work. They just want to get on with the next one and get it out of their head, or their heart, or their soul, or whatever. Whereas others are thinking, how will people respond to this? This isn't gonna work. People won't realize what I'm trying to say. And it leads to very different kinds of art.
And they're both valid.
Absolutely. Both just as valid. Representational excellence.
One is the
excellence.
Kind of guy that maybe in 100 years has discovered and is being made famous because people can...
They can relate to what he's doing.
And
yeah.
Finally get where he's at.
Yeah.
And sometimes society has to catch up.
Yeah.
In both cases, though, this applies.
Absolutely.
The clarity of the idea is it. I mean, when I'm in the studio alone, and in the cave of making, and with no sense of maybe ever showing it, maybe I'm spending my life on one work, it's still the same rule applies.
Right.
The
right.
other is more like stirring, immediately stirring that idea in the viewer. And the viewer, in many cases for that artist, is kind of the artwork.
Yeah.
So it's kind of two points of view.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there and in performing arts, very often,
performing arts is
the
very
audience
much
is
that.
Is totally critical. Of course, not, again, there's some avant-garde approaches to performance where you don't care about the audience and you hope they won't see it or something. But it's that same thing, the technical precision and control required to do a really fine etching or a really precise architectural drawing. The architectural drawings of the Brooklyn Bridge that they unearthed in that deep storage chamber, a couple of years ago, are inevitably works of art. You can't just call them technical. They're brilliant. They convey something, and they convey that precision of mind that the creators of them were absorbed in while they were making them, even though they were making them with measurements and rulers and compasses and things.
Yeah, because if you have clarity, like you were saying, the clarity of vision, whoever sees that and you are conveying it effectively the way Rothko was describing, whoever sees that, even if they don't think they're interested in that kind of art, are going to feel something from that. It's like, yeah. You know, you go to a museum and you may have your certain areas of the museum that you know you want to see. I want to see the post-impressionists because those are my favorite artists. But in the process, you're walking through rooms of other kinds of art. And in spite of yourself, you get drawn into paintings you don't think you're going to like. You may not understand them at all, but you feel this because the artist in bringing that out and expressing that was clear in this path to from the inner vision to the canvas or sculpture or whatever it was.
I think if the student who comes in and wants to paint what the flower did to him, mm-hmm. he needs to just keep painting anything. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't have to be a flower. It doesn't matter what medium it's in. If he keeps remembering or reliving the thing the flower did to him, that will get caught in whatever he uses to express himself. Somewhere it'll be there.
We just actually had a class yesterday on that. People wanted a class on painting flowers, and so I had a class in painting flowers, but the first thing that I did was show them a whole pile of art books of different painters' paintings of flowers. Matisse, Rousseau, Georgia O'Keeffe, Paul Klee. Mm-hmm. There's much variety as possible of how you can paint flowers. And it was mind-blowing to them because in their minds they were going to, you know, come in and just paint a flower
getting
that looks
petals
like a flower.
In perspective.
And and all three of the people who were doing this were not experienced artists. They hadn't painted much at all. But they tapped into that, just what you were describing as their feeling about the flower. And one person painted an iris, another person painted a sunflower, another person painted a meadow filled with flowers with her dog sort of behind the grasses in there. Mm-hmm. And they were all successful. They were all delightful, full of energy and just the spark of their relationship to those flowers. But I don't think it would have happened if they hadn't looked at all of these great artists' ways of portraying flowers to see how you have to come from what's inside yourself. You can't just do it on, you know, a good rendering.
Yeah, there isn't a specific hand motion that corresponds to that aspect of what you're feeling about the flower. Mm-hmm. And that other aspect doesn't have a hand motion assigned to it either.
Right.
Or a color or a type of brush or a medium or anything. But it's so tempting to think of the graphic arts as being an analog to the camera. It was the other way around when the camera came out. It was, oh my goodness, this is an alternative to a painting. And maybe it's because of photography that we learned so quickly that painting just isn't photography with ink or
that
or
the whole
paint.
Of 20th century art is the byproduct of rediscovering the potential for creative expression through painting and sculpture, as opposed to it having that job of recording the surface level of life. my feeling is that every form and every color has meaning. It has a precise meaning that that runs the gamut of human experience. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's, I believe, what he's exploring here. When he uses minimal color and minimal form, nothing is not meaningful. I mean, he's every stroke, everything he puts in there, everything that any artist puts into the artwork has a meaning, whether it's conscious or unconscious. It has a meaning that works on the viewer.
Yeah.
And if you can become a master of the meaning of form, and what each color and each color combination and each quality of shape does to your own emotions and your heart and mind,
yeah,
then you'll know how to work with that in moving the viewer. And anyone who composes in music or composes in visual art becomes a master at this. I mean, if they become a master.
Isn't it interesting? Yes, everyone who works in music has a master.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we aspire to.
But isn't that interesting? I really kind of tripped over the idea that a Rothko is minimal. Because in a way,
no, it's really,
it's the opposite.
Right, it's totally
it
complex,
looks, it's yeah. deceptively minimal.
Right.
That's not blue. It's 1,000 colors. And it's not a rectangle with rounded edges or something, rounded corners. It's a really subtle interplay of color fields with an intermediate region that's so complicated you can't even begin to describe that. And it's just sort of the border. But it isn't a border at all. It's too important to be a border. And there's so much, just in terms of the visual complexity of it, that if you look at it up close, there's millions of things going on. And to actually define it in any geometric way is impossible. Although if you glance at a print of one in an art book, that, you know, and the print is 4 or 5 inches tall, it's obviously a blue all rounded rectangle on an orange background, which is totally irrelevant.
Well, and with a good painting, whether it's a Rothko or Cezanne apples or whatever, when that process has happened, when the artist has had that clarity and really got it onto the canvas, even though it's a two-dimensional plane, what you feel like when you're looking at that paint, you feel like you could crawl around inside it and explore and swim around. It's like you look at a Rothko rectangle and all of those colors that are there draw you into it and you feel it from the inside. And the mm-hmm. same thing with A Still Life by Cezanne. You can crawl around and look behind the apples, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And you can, they evoke worlds that are far different from the two-dimensional surface of a canvas, even if they're not representational at all.
Yeah. Rothko is kind of amazing to me because I put him kind of in the same position as Beckett in theater. My favorite playwright is Shakespeare. What can I say? I'm not original when it comes to that. But my second favorite playwright is Beckett, and he just kind of wipes out the theater. It's done. After Godot, you don't need to do any more plays. The whole thing is over. Mm-hmm. It's been said. There's nothing more profound that could possibly be said than what he says in Godot. And I still enjoy going to the theater. And Rothko kind of does that with painting. It's once you've fallen into a couple of Rothkos, as a prospective painter or two-dimensional graphic artist, I can't think of anything worth even attempting.
And that's why we describe, and critics have described, work after that period as after the end of art.
Yeah. After the end of theater and the end of art, what else can we end in the 21st century?
Well, we can't stop it. It yeah. keeps going, and yeah. creativity continues.
Yeah.
But this paradigm of the art, the grand narrative of art, is often considered to have come to a close there.
Yeah.
So well, a new narrative is starting then.
What's that?
So a new narrative can
oh,
start.
Oh, absolutely.
Now,
the beginning of a new paradigm.
Yes, yeah, so maybe a non-narrative one. You know, there's been so much emphasis on the history of art as being some sort of linear progression.
Exactly.
And it isn't a progression. It's just a series of phases that may not have any real relationship to one another at all. And there's yeah. no reason why the next phase has to have anything to say about the previous phase or the previous mm-hmm. six phases.
Well, I think we're entering the phase of the integration of art and life.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Art and being.
But this, whatever the phase is, this quote that we started out with still applies.
Right, right.
Yes.
It's just, you know, because that's the, he kind of got to the core of the process, the creative process, no matter what you're creating.
Exactly.
Yes, there's no such thing as a good painting about nothing.
Right.
It's about something. If it's any good at all, it's about something.
Mm-hmm.
And it maybe, in the case of really refined architectural drawings, it's about precision, and it's about dimensions, and it's about absolute two-dimensionality and things like that. And cleanliness and you know, precision and stuff. But it's still about something.
It's like the same thing if you want to just bring it into other areas of life. It's like cooking is not just about fueling the body. And there's deep emotion. The whole process of eating meals in every culture, and there are all the traditions, and a cook's relationship to food, and a dining table's, all the people in their relationship to food is much bigger, more deeper, more authentic, more cosmic, more mysterious than just providing something that fuels
the
body.
And to extend that, it extends to everything.
To everything,
but it brings us to the what is the content of anything we do?
Mm-hmm.
We're describing here the meaningful content in anything we do, and it applies to everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's really saying that giving meaning to action, to activity, is what makes it good.
Mm.
And that if you're doing it while you're asleep, and it's unimportant, it's irrelevant.
Which is an easy thing to fall into, you know,
if you
wake up in the morning and you have your to-do list.
Uh-huh.
And you're never engaged in any of the steps because you're always just thinking about getting on to the next one, finishing this one. And if you have a day like that, those days are just so tiring, and you may check off everything from your to-do list, but at the end of the day, you don't have the sense of fulfillment that you have when you've done one thing with this meaningful engagement, and it's different.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.